All right. Welcome to Women in Environmental Science. Good morning, good evening, and good afternoon to everyone listening. I'm Serenia Nantapuntla, and I have Dr. Francesca De Domenico with me today. Thank you so much for coming to my podcast today, Dr. Francesca.
Thanks to you for inviting me. It's such a pleasure, and I'm so excited to talking with you.
As am I. So to get us started, could you elaborate more on who you are, where you're from, and what work you're doing?
Yeah, of course, sure. So my name is Francesca De Domenico, and I am an assistant professor in sustainable aircraft propulsion. So if we wanted to go in what I'm doing, if I want to say what I'm doing in a fancy way, I can say that I am a rocket engineer, a rocket scientist that is playing with fire and is shining lasers into flames. That sounds very cool, but if we want to change it in a bit more common terms, I am a professor in aerospace engineering. I studied aerospace engineering for my bachelor, master, and PhD, and now I do research on flames. As you might guess from my accent, I am Italian. So I come from Italy. I was born in Northern Italy, and then I studied my bachelor and my master degree in Padova, that is a city in the north of Italy. And then for my PhD, I moved to the United Kingdom, to the University of Cambridge. I did my PhD in aerospace engineering, and in particular, my focus was on combustion. At the end of my PhD, I did an internship in a place that is called the KAUST, that is a campus university in Saudi Arabia, where they have a very big experimental facilities where I could train a bit more and get new skills. And then I came back to the United Kingdom, where I had a 3 years I had a research fellowship for 3 years, where I was working as a researcher still at the University of Cambridge. During these 3 years, I also got a British citizenship. So I am now Italian and British, well, naturalized British. But then I needed to move on, and like the career call arrived, and therefore I decided to apply for this position in Delft for becoming an assistant professor at TU Delft. So Delft is a small city in the Netherlands, and I guess that for people in the US, maybe that doesn't ring a bell, but I'll try to tell you something about Delft. So maybe people know about this painting, The Girl with the Pearl Earring. And there is also like a movie about that, of that with Scarlett Johansson, I believe. And the painter who painted these portraits was born in Delft. Right. So Delft is the city of Vermeer. And for my point of view, Delft is the best one of the best technical campus in Europe, and is the best for aerospace engineering. And in particular, what I really appreciate of this university is that it's really looking at sustainability from all the sides, not just on aerospace engineering, but also like for like building technologies, architecture, mechanical science. So it's that's really the focus. And it's a very great, vibrant community, which I really like. So, yeah. That's a bit about me. And yeah, and one disclaimer for this. So I've been living and talking with engineers for like more than 10 years now. So if I do have some technical terms that are not clear, please stop me and tell me to explain that for like common people term, because now, you know, you get a bit of biased of the brain.
Absolutely. Totally makes sense. I mean, that sounds wonderful. Turning lasers into fire. Like, can you elaborate on that? That sounds extremely cool.
Yeah, sure. So let's say that like I'm studying the behavior of a flame, mm-hmm. and I want to extract a quantity out of it. So when we want to measure temperature in a human, we just get a thermometer, mm-hmm. that is mainly made of plastics with some metal, and we put like in our mouth, let's say. You cannot do really the same with a flame, because it's going to melt. And even if you were to go like with a more resistant material, the temperature of a flame might be around 3000 Fahrenheit. So even metals are going to burn. And you cannot really, and so if you want to get an information in the very center of the flame, there's no way you can go down there with any kind of probe. Right. And so the idea is, okay, how can I measure the temperature of, let's call it, the heart of a flame? And to do so, we use what is called non-intrusive measurement techniques. So we are sending, let's say, a signal inside the flame. This signal, that is our laser beam, is interacting with the molecules in the flame. And the response of the molecules to this laser beam will be different based on, for example, the local temperature. So we are getting out, let's say, a response signal that is has some special feature given, for example, by the temperature of the molecules at the point. And then by some we use some algorithm to get out the information that we are looking for. So it's kind of like an indirect way of measuring things. It's not like a plug and play. Let's say it's not that we put in a laser and then we get out the information. There's a bit more that the thing is a bit more convoluted, but it works because we are like literally taking advantage of the various physical behavior and principles of flames. Another reason why we are doing this is because let's say the scales, the length scales of our experiment that matter are very small. With this, what I mean is that like even, let's say a probe that is a couple of millimeter is going to make a substantial change in the behavior of what we are looking. So if we were to put something inside the flow, we'll have a modified flow, a modified flame. And so we are losing a bit of information. And so we prefer to do everything from remote and just having laser sheets or laser beams that are going in and then getting the information out.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. Like it's like a way of measuring the flame's temperature. And like you mentioned, it's not like a direct way, but you can use that analysis to get your temperature, which is
exactly. Yeah, and also as a lot of series of other techniques, because for example, like we can also measure density or concentration of molecules, or even let's say what's there. Because for example, when you have a flame, you have flame product and you might not know what's inside. So you want to say, to know, let's say, what's the percentage of carbon dioxide emitted? And so you can, let's say, tune your technique to have something that is only like targeting carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. And therefore you are having an information that is somewhat linked to the amount of carbon dioxide that you are looking at. And so you can say, oh, well, okay, then it means that, like the 30% is carbon dioxide.
Absolutely. So is this technology like used for wildfires?
There are some technologies that can work with them. So because we are using what is called laser class 4 laser, so those are the kind of like the most dangerous one. And we are using very high level of energies for which we really need to be careful about our highs. So we try to do these measurements in, let's say, in enclosed environment. However, more and more, they are trying to do further experiments in which they go to wildfire and they are sending, let's say, lasers that have perhaps less power or less, let's say, less energy, or at least like make sure that like the environment is clear. And one very cool thing that they are doing is doing this by drones. Because of course, sometimes it's very hard to get close to a fire for a human being. But if you do that via a drone that is set to stand at the given temperature or density, then you can get the information much closer.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, drones have been really, really useful for like wildfire-based things or just fire things in general, because people can't get close to those. Because fire is harmful, right? So drones are like the second best way to do it. And I love that we're now bringing more innovative technology. It's not just the same types of technology. We're seeing it progress and get better. So you're getting more like better results, better views on what you're trying to study.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So like how does, I think you kind of briefly talked about this earlier, but like experiments with fire, is it more lab-based? You said there was like algorithms and things. So is it like also like more computer or database?
Half and half. So that's somewhat that's somewhat there we somewhat work in a happy middle, in the happy middle. So we have experiments that are a scaled version of what's happening in reality. At least for university, it's very hard to get a one-to-one scale of, for example, a big air engine combustor. And so we need to play with what we have. The experiment that therefore is representative, but how can we assess whether what we are looking is realistic or not is often via algorithm. So we have some scaling laws, some algorithms that are taking, let's say, what's happening in reality. We are scaling it down to something that we can handle, and then we made experiment. Experiments somewhat are complicated, and by the amount of time that it requires to build all a setup and put all the probes, all the diagnostics around it, and make sure that the data algorithms work, it takes ages. So the idea is that the experiment and computer-based programs, or what we call simulation, work hand to hand. So the experiment is only a single case, and the simulation can look at several cases by changing, for example, one parameter, let's say the amount of fuel that you're putting in. If the corresponding experiment is giving the same result of the simulation, then we say the simulation is valid. Therefore, we can tweak the parameters of the simulation to eventually get to what's the best configuration and update the experiment. I don't know if this makes sense and if this answers your question, but that's to say that it's a very convoluted the let's say the experimental work with the simulation work. And of course, also we need to model what we are getting out of the experiment. And there is a second algorithm style.
Yeah, absolutely. That answers my question. It's just like you mentioned, you have that lab component, which is not exactly the same as the field, because it's really hard and dangerous to do it in the field. But like you can take that lab data and then model that and use simulations to predict what the lab data would do. So it's like they're both feeding each other. Which is very cool that you get to work with different mediums of like research. Like, for example, right now I'm doing research on algal blooms, and like what I've been able to like go in the field and treat a pond of algal blooms. And then I've done a lab experiment, and I've also done a data project. So I think that's just like really wonderful. You get experience to all these different ways of working. You're not just sticking to one. And it's more fun.
Absolutely, indeed.
So I wanted to move over to your aviation research. So do you want to give a brief overview of what the current state of aviation is and its current impacts on the environment?
Absolutely, yeah. So the current state of aviation is that we have, with respect to 120 years ago, we clearly have more efficient airplanes. But we have way more airplanes, and the number of flights is increasing. Even if COVID hit and the aviation sector had a big crisis, now we are seeing the numbers skyrocketing back up. And we can assume that in the coming years, there are going to be more and more passenger flights flying, more planes, more flights. Mm-hmm. So the picture is that aviation is a growing sector. And as much as we can increase the efficiency, we are still a very polluting way. We are still very polluting. So if we wanted to look at the number, aviation in the US, for example, is 11% of all the emission of the transportation. Mm-hmm. And worldwide, the emissions of aviation, it's 3-4% of all the total of carbon dioxide emission. Mm-hmm. And probably I'll take a step back and I'll try to explain why planes are polluting. So planes work with the engines. So we are burning fuels in order to generate thrust, which is the force that is making the plane fly, going, let's say, from one city to the other. Yeah. At the moment, So when you see the engine, they're like, that's something that for me, it's very normal, but maybe people don't know that. But you have two or more big flames inside the engine that are on all the time you're flying.
Oh.
So that's the reason why, let's say, what's happening in an airplane is not that different to what's happening in a car. Of course, the mechanism is totally different because a car engine works on a totally different principle. But then the idea that there is something hot that is burning is the same. So when we are talking about electric car, we should also think that we would like to have electric plane, because even the planes are burning fuel. And actually, the planes are burning an immense amount of fuel with respect to the fuel that is burned by a car. Mm-hmm. So if you want to take, let's say, a return trip from New York to San Francisco, your flight is probably going to be 20% of the emission of your car in 1 year. So it's for just, let's say, how many hours? 10 hours flying. So it's quite, let's say, it's quite a substantial impact. The reason why the overall number is little is because not everyone is flying, and therefore, like, you can take it down, but on per se, the planes are very polluting.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why burning thing is polluting the environment and creating, let's say, contributing to the global warming is the kind of fuel that we are currently using. So when we are talking about global warming, mm-hmm. we're talking about mainly about releasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And the carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, therefore, like, it's making a sort of greenhouse inside the world. And we are warm, and the greenhouse is keeping it inside the atmosphere. And so the planet is getting warmer and warmer and warmer. The reason why this is bad is because of the composition of this fuel. So we call them fossil fuels because we take them out of the ground. Those were in, let's say, some petrol is in, let's say that I am a piece of petrol and I am in the sea, and I am made by a lot of carbon dioxide, but I'm fine. I'm not polluting. Mm-hmm. In the moment in which you are taking me out of the sea and you are burning me, I am becoming carbon dioxide that is released into the atmosphere. And this was not supposed to happen. So we are taking things out of the that is fossil inside the sea, right. And we are dropping it into the atmosphere in an enormous amount.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what we want. And unfortunately, at the moment, there is the only fuel that we are using for aviation are fossil fuels. And that's why at the moment there is this urgent call of, let's say, making the aviation sector greener. Mm. So there are good news into this. The picture is not as bad as it seems, because finally, let's say, world leader, especially in the last couple of years, are really using all their energies in order to make sure that, like, aviation is going to stick to the pledges of plus 1.5 degrees / zero emission by 2050. And that's great, because aviation is going to be a very hard sector to decarbonize and to make green. So the fact that, like, 200 countries have agreed on going for this objective of zero emissions flight by 2050 is a great achievement for all the aviation community. Reason why I'm saying that aviation is slightly harder to decarbonize is because of the complexity of the airplane. So if you have a car that is burning diesel and you have a lot of space to change the engine of your car and make it, let's say, an engine that is hybrid and is burning hydrogen and gasoline at some point, there is space because you don't have the constraint of flying. But when you have a plane and you have to fly, then every kilograms of extra material or of extra structure that you have to bring up you need some fuel to bring that up. And so it's kind of, you are creating this circle in which the heavier your structure is, the more fuel you need. And so you can lose a lot of inefficiency. And that's why it's while for cars, we have a bit more room for, let's say, making sure that the target is hit in 2050. For aviation, this means that like that we must speed up in terms of evolution, in terms of like finding new technologies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And just like going back to that example you gave where New York to San Francisco. So if you take a flight from New York to San Francisco, usually I'm not sure how many people would be on that flight, but let's say instead of flying, they all drove. And all these individual people driving in different cars, would that like carbon emission from those passengers, there's cars, will all that carbon that's emitted from that, will that still be less than what's emitted from that one plane they took?
I think that like if you look at a long distance, you are right. If all the people drive singularly, then the carbon emission from the car is going to kind of like match up the carbon emission of a plane. So for something that is, let's say, a long distance, 6-7 hour flight, it might be still convenient to fly. Plus there is all the, let's say, the time that a person is taking for going to New York to San Francisco. When instead we are talking about small distances that can be, for example, New York, Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. then in that case, those are the flights that are the worst one. And especially one of the things that is polluting enormously, considering the distances that they are flying, are business flights. So let's say the private jet of a person that has to travel 400 kilometers and does that by flight for it's basically one person in one plane, and that's like the most polluting thing one person can think of.
So like until we have our more greener flights, until we have like electric flights, then our goal as just like the general public should be, don't take a flight that is shorter than like 6 or 7 hours, because then you can drive and that will release less carbon. I mean, this depends on people's situations and everything, but you know, just like in general, keep that in mind when looking at planes.
Yeah, I mean, I say that like rather than drive, if there was like a train, that would be better. But then like I know that like this is very different between me and you, because in Europe we have a very great rail, and with our train system is quite advanced, or at least in most of the countries in Europe. But I know that in the US, it gets a bit more complicated to take the train. So I'd say that, yes, if you have a long trip to do, then take the flight. It's saving you time, stress, and overall, like the impact is not going to be as bad. But if you have a very short trip, try to do it with public transport or with a car with 4 or 5 people. And that's going to be the best. And also, like, I think what we know that like it's impossible to stop people from flying. COVID arrived, no one was flying. As soon as they opened up the border, I don't know if you've seen the chaos that we had in the airport in Europe last summer. Everyone was trying to fly, and there was like a massive mess. So stopping people from flight is not going to happen, but do it with, let's say, in a rational way. Do not fly if you have a 1 hour meeting in another city. Do it on Zoom. Maybe it's not as effective, but the pollutants that you are emitting the atmosphere for this 1 hour is not worth it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think what's nice about COVID is that we've been able to move over to like a more just technology-based thing. We don't need to like for research conferences, you don't need to go in person all the time. There's an option of like being online and having that hybrid system. Like if you're able to come in person and want to, then go ahead. But if you want to just like stay at your place and, you know, not release that carbon or whatever the situation is, you have that option. So it's just, I love that COVID is like able to help us like transfer to more like online technology. And I think that's exactly what happened with my podcast, because I started the podcast during like COVID time, and I was able to like be like, I can't fly to Denver if I want to interview someone there. So let me just do it on Zoom. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. It started a bunch of great initiatives. And I think that's the best part about it.
Yeah, indeed, because if you were to fly to the Netherlands for one interview, that's probably going to have a very bad carbon footprint.
Yeah, very. And it would be just like against everything this podcast is about. So I'm happy that we are able to do this. So what's like the plan for future airplanes and like getting that green energy?
Yeah, so the plan is to totally change the way in which the airport these airplane work and the technology of the airplane. Mm-hmm. So what we want people to do is to be ready to engage in the process of flying on something that doesn't look like a plane anymore, perhaps. No, here I'm joking, but for example, in my research group, some people are doing some research on something that is called a flying V, where rather than having a single fuselage, the plane looks like a V, and so there are two fuselages. And this seems like a very environment-friendly concept. So right now, there are all of these technologies that are trying to totally disrupt the way in which we were flying. Now, without going into this totally revolutionary shape, if I take a step back and I look at how the airplanes can look like, I can, there are like 3-4 options. And the truth is that like as of now, we are still in the exploration time. So we haven't set yet all our efforts on one single technologies. Mm-hmm. But different manufacturers, different countries and different continents are looking at different possible solutions, and we are still trying to explore which one is the best one. What's clear is that there won't be a single technology for all the fleet. Yeah. So probably a transatlantic flight will use a different technologies rather than as a shorter flight. Mm-hmm. But with all the same goal of having zero carbon emitted from the plane. Right. So I can start from the shorter distance flights, and then I can progress up in describing how we think the airplane fleet is going to look like in 40, 50 years. Mm-hmm. So shorter distance flights are the one that we believe can work with batteries. So for, let's say, a couple hundreds of kilometers, mm-hmm. then batteries are going to be enough to power these aircrafts. Now, these aircrafts might be a bit slower, but still they can fly. They can the time that you save by using a flight is going to compensate for the fact that the plane is slower. Now, the problem is that like if you start to go, if you need to go further, you need more energy. And batteries are not going to be enough to provide enough energy and power to go for, let's say, 500 kilometers. The reason is that like if you were to fly 500 kilometers, you'd need so much battery that then you need extra energy to bring up your battery. And so you get into this circle for which your plane will get heavier and heavier and heavier just to bring up the power to power the plane. So this sounds a bit weird, but the story is that like batteries are not going to be a technology for long distance flight.
Right.
Then if we start to think, okay, what can we do in between? Then here there is something that are called the fuel cell, that are battery, but in this case they are powered by hydrogen. So hydrogen is going to be hydrogen is going to power this fuel cell, and there is going to be a propeller that is driving the plane. And still, this can work for the short medium range distance. Now we are, the bigger chunk is missing. So what for the medium to long distance? Mm-hmm. And here, the Europe and the US seem to have a bit of different opinion. So for Europe, we want to burn hydrogen. So rather than using the fossil fuel, for Europe, hydrogen is going to be the main fuel for aviation. So we are thinking about how to make hydrogen planes in the future. Mm-hmm. For the United States, instead, as of now, let's say, or a couple of months ago when I got the last information, the idea was to use synthetic aviation fuel. So synthetic aviation fuel are fuels that don't come from, let's say, from petrol, but they are made in different ways. For example, we can have fuel that come from organic sources like biomass, or like even from rubbish or from any other kind of like garbage or like leftovers from, for example, from when the forest when or like from other industrial processes. So this fuel, this is one category. Then there is another category that are fuel that are used, taking the carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and they are like, and by using a series of reaction, they are making a pseudo fossil fuel. But in this case, it's renewable because it's removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And those are called e-fuels. So you sort of have a fake fossil fuel that in this case is man-made.
Mm-hmm.
And because you are removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, overall your net is zero. So you have a flight, you burnt it, but then you take it back, you remake fuel with that, you burn it again, and overall you are not contributing to add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
So is this with the hydrogen based or the synthetic?
That's synthetic. Yeah.
Gotcha. And what do you think? Just like an unbiased look at these two different methods, what do you think would be more environmentally friendly and also cheaper? Because that's a big factor we have to consider.
So unfortunately, both all these ways are all more expensive. Mm-hmm. So we have to consider the fact that like prices will go up, but then like we also need to think on the other way. The investment for these novel technologies has to be massive, mm-hmm. but the amount of money that we will have to pay if we don't stick into this 1.5 degrees C to counteract against all the adverse climate event that we're going to have is going to be much higher. So climate change is going to be overall way more costly than investing in novel and more expensive technologies. And this is not me saying that. Those are numbers. And even if it's getting clearer and clearer that the target of 1.5 is going to be very difficult to reach, everyone is now saying that like the cost of even 0.1 temperature increase more is going to be way more.
Right.
So for me, I believe that hydrogen has a lot of potential in terms of fuel because overall it's greener than using other materials. And also hydrogen doesn't interfere, for example, from the food chain. If we were to use fuels that come from products that are, let's say, taken from the fields or from the woods, then we might start interfering with, for example, animals or like with the animals, local animals, with the forest, or with also what we have to eat.
Yeah, I mean, I think one important thing to think about, just like from the general public perspective, is that we've gotten into this cycle where we always want the perfect thing. Like it has to work perfectly. It has to be the right price. But I think that like with climate technology and trying to use, like, this is all new technology. We haven't done this before. So it's not going to be perfect as soon as you implement it in the field. But what the public needs to like change their mindset in order to allow for these technologies to happen is that not everything is going to be perfect. It might not look like a plane, like you said. It might look like something else. It might be a longer flight than what it usually was. But overall, it's going to be better for you, for like your health, like you're breathing in these like the smog related stuff that's associated with carbon dioxide and SO2 and NOx and stuff. But if you think about it, like if we switch our mindset, we think that this technology is going to do great. We just need to give it a little bit of time. It's going to like help you and few generations to come.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Also, I think that at some point, even if the public doesn't want, there will be laws and regulations that won't allow fossil fuel to be emitted in the atmosphere. So for example, a week ago in Europe, we had a ban. They've set a ban on selling fossil fuel burning car from 2035, meaning that all the cars will have to be either electric or probably hybrid or like hydrogen powered, but you won't be able to have any more your gasoline or diesel car. And that's a small step, but if you think that like more and more of this regulation will come into place, then actually, even if a person doesn't want to, the market won't allow them to buy the kind of technology they want.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what I'm thinking. Like, it's, you just have to give it time. So I wanted to ask, like, what is your research like with these airplanes? Like, do you study how the hydrogen like can be used, or what's like, yeah, what's the research like?
Yeah, so me and my team, we are looking into how hydrogen burn in terms of, as I explained before, like the technology is going to be very different. So the engine itself need to be designed in a different way in order to accommodate hydrogen as a fuel. Mm. So the current planes are flying burning kerosene kerosene plus air is delivering in the atmosphere CO2 and other like CO2 and water. Now, if we take hydrogen and we burn hydrogen, what's left in the atmosphere from the reaction is only water. Right. So the reaction is totally different. And by itself, hydrogen is very different from kerosene. So the molecular weight of a kerosene molecule is 170. The molecular weight of a molecule of hydrogen is 1. So those are totally different fuels.
Yeah.
Which means that the combustion will happen in a totally different way. The flame will look much different. Actually, one cool thing is that hydrogen flames are basically transparent. So it's not the yellow flame you think of. You won't even see them. And so if you start adding up all of these things, and the fact that like we really never had the chance to explore the potential of hydrogen, then the research that we need to make now in order to ensure that in, let's say, 10-year time, we can have an airplane fully powered by hydrogen is massive, because we really need to understand how this fuel is performing, what are the overall emissions, which kind of design the combustion chamber itself has to have in order for having a very efficient engine. Because not only we want to burn hydrogen, but we want to burn hydrogen in a safe, clean, and efficient way.
Yeah, so is there, how will that, like, hydrogen burning affect, like, from a passenger's point of view, how will it affect their experience? Like, will it be safe for them to fly in these planes? Do we know that?
So the safety regulation will be the same on the flight. So the experience should be nearly the same. And that's what we want. So that our goal is that like a passenger on an hydrogen powered plane will feel exactly the same thing. Mm-hmm. On the technology point of view, the plane has to be very different because of these different properties of hydrogen with respect to kerosene. Yeah, so for example,
you can't just replace it into the plane.
No, but I think the most striking thing is the fuel tank. Mm-hmm. So as of now, when a plane is flying, has to carry all the fuel with itself. And normally the fuel is stored into the wings. Mm-hmm. So this works with kerosene because it's much denser, but hydrogen has to be liquefied. So it has to be at a different temperature and also is as a way lower density. If you have something that is, let's say, if you imagine to fill the wing of your plane with hydrogen, mm-hmm. and then removing a lot of it over the flight to burn it because of there is, let's say, you need more in order to achieve go through the same distance, then at a certain point, the balance of the mass in your plane is going to be totally different. So storing the hydrogen inside the wing is not going to work. And so the shape of the plane itself has to be rearranged in order to make sure that your hydrogen tank has to be there, right. Has to like can be there and can safely store the hydrogen. Now, you raise a very good question, because the problem for us is not just the safety. We are 100% sure that as soon as the hydrogen planes are going to be released, they're going to have the same safety requirements or the current one. The problem is the public perception. And we know that people tend to think that hydrogen is going to be more dangerous than a normal plane, which might have been the case, let's say 100 years ago, when there were something like the Hindenburg disaster, that was this flying ship carrying hydrogen that kind of exploded at the end. Maybe you don't have this image in your mind, but some people might remember it. So it was a big transatlantic flying ship that was powered by hydrogen, and eventually hydrogen took fire. And people think about that when you mention hydrogen flying. And instead, the perception of the passenger has to be that it doesn't matter of what's the fuel, the plane will always bring you from A to B with the same level of safety and of comfort. And if only, you might be on a better plane, because now we have a better way of designing things, right. And also engineers have a much better understanding of human comfort. So also having a new design of a plane will give us, let's say, a bit of room for improving the overall passenger perception of the plane.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's why advocation is so important, advocating about aviation and how it's changed, and how hydrogen can be used and in a safe manner, because that was such a long time ago. Some people might not think of it, I've never heard of that, but that's good to know that there's people out there who do think about that and refer back to that one specific example as saying that all hydrogen fuel planes are bad. But that's why it's great you're doing this podcast, so we can really fix that stigma of hydrogen fuel. So is this hydrogen fuel, I know there are cars in California and other places where you have hydrogen fueled cars. So can this technology transfer over to cars and be used in a more more cars using hydrogen fuel?
I don't think you can really transfer the airplane technology to car. What you can do is using the common things that you learn, for example, from a combustion process, and look at the consequence that has for car manufacturers and for airplane manufacturers. So the physical behavior would be similar, but because of the differences in the application, the same properties will have very different consequences in the way in which these two means of transportation work. The one thing that is going to be in common, and that's why it's also important that other hydrogen is used for other things rather than only aviation, is that the more hydrogen is required, the more hydrogen is produced. So it will get cheaper, it will get easier to be produced, it will get easier to be transported, and there is going to be all the infrastructure network that we need to make sure that airport will have a constant supply of hydrogen and will be able to refuel all the planes landing there.
Yeah, that brings up a really good point. Where does the hydrogen even come from in the first place? How do we make hydrogen fuel?
So there are, the thing is we make it from water most of the times, and we need the energy to create single hydrogen. So a molecule of water is H2O. Mm-hmm. And from this molecule, we want to take out the O and only leave the H2. For doing that, we need the energy. So you might have heard of the colors of hydrogen. So we talk about green hydrogen, yeah. Blue hydrogen, pink hydrogen, purple hydrogen, whatever kind of color. And that refers to the ways in which the hydrogen is produced. Mm. So blue hydrogen is using, for example, natural gas for its production. And that's why it's considered a bit less green, because you are still using something that is somewhat polluting to produce hydrogen. Instead, the green hydrogen is produced by renewable sources of energies. So, for example, can be solar, can be wind energy, can be sun, like other biomass sources of energies. And the as of now, there isn't enough production capability to fulfill all the needs that, let's say, the aviation sector will have. But the more also that the more technology evolves for these renewable sources of energy, the more energy sources we will have to produce this hydrogen.
Right, gotcha. Makes sense. But something else I want to think about is like this technology seems really, really good for the environment. But like for every new technology, there's always two sides of it. There's always the good part, but also the risks and disadvantages. So what are those risks and disadvantages about hydrogen-fueled planes?
Well, I mean, the first disadvantage is the kind of like, is the fact that like being so light, you'll need a lot of like, you'll need a bigger volume to have your tank.
Mm-hmm.
And then there, and that is causing a lot of problems in terms of like structure, in terms of like weight distribution, in terms of design. Also, the problem is that hydrogen, in order to be effectively stored in the fuselage, has to be stored liquefied.
Mm-hmm.
And the temperature of liquid hydrogen has to be around minus 460 Fahrenheit. So it's 20 Kelvin. So you need to have a tank in your airplane that can stay, can be at 20 Kelvin, which means that like you need a lot of advantages also in the terms of materials, as well as, let's say, insulators to make sure that like this is the case. And also this has to be very well sealed, because otherwise if there is even the smallest leakage, then the tank is not affecting anymore. This is only one single problem for the, let's say, structure wise. Mm-hmm. But then there are a lot of other problems in terms of like building all the infrastructure for this. So let's say now all the airports are equipped for kerosene. Kerosene is much easier to transport. Now, let's say that we need to totally change this, and we need airports big as, I don't know, JFK or like San Francisco Airport, Los Angeles Airport, for all a fleet of hydrogen airplanes. Like the investment of infrastructure has to be massive. And how can we, and the time is really ticking, so it will be very hard to make sure that by 2050, all the big and small airport will be able to have enough hydrogen to refill all the flights that are coming there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. So it does. So like I was also wanting to talk about like the structure and how like we're trying to make the fuel more green, but also is there a way that we can make like the structure of the plane, like the building of the plane, like more based off of an environmentally friendly process?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So the studies for these new airplanes are looking at all the ways to improve efficiency of the system. Mm-hmm. So let's say a 1% improvement in the efficiency of any kind of component of a plane is going to be a 1% in let's say improvement in the revenue. So in the money that you get out of it. So of course, like the fact that like we are totally redesigning the system is giving us way more opportunities to make sure that like we take care of all the details of the new system to have a better shape, a less losses in the plane, having something that is more compact, more lightweight. So there is a lot of research that is going around how to build this plane of the future themselves to make them as environment friendly and let's say as efficient as possible.
Right. And I think that that's also a very important aspect to have, like just not just the fuel, but the entire plane should be like built off of like when taking mining and the minerals used in making the plane, into consideration, it needs to all be totally green so we can reduce our impact on the environment. So I was curious, like, throughout when we've been talking, you've been really, really interested. You've gained so much knowledge. It's really fascinating to hear about how planes can like be more green. So what got you interested in working in getting to like sustainable aviation?
So I can start on why I got interested into aviation, and then I'll say why I got interested in sustainable aviation. So I got interested into aviation because my first flight was canceled. So I had a lot of time at the airport waiting for the next flight. And then I had a lot of time to look at airplanes, how they were working, the noise that they were emitting, the smoke that was coming out of their engines. And that really fascinated me. I was 12 at the time. And so that's why I decided that I wanted to work in aviation. And then that's why I enrolled into my programs. And then for sustainable aviation it's a series of reasons. The first one is that I really love traveling. Mm-hmm. So the idea of not being able to do that and not to be able to explore anymore the world because like I'm polluting it, it was really heartbreaking for me. Mm-hmm. And also that was one of the reasons why I realized that actually I had to use my aerospace engineering background to do something good for the environment. And the second reason was way more linked to COVID, was the fact that like everything stopped, and I realized that like COVID was a great opportunity for us to rethink the way in which we were doing things. And while, let's say, human mobility, airplanes, cars were all grounded, mm-hmm. the environment was not grounded. So we could see in the last couple of years a lot of, natural disasters happening. And that was all caused by what we had done to the planet in the years before. And that was a very big call for me to say that we had to do something to change this. And that's why I decided to take up this position in sustainable aviation and making sure that 100% of my effort is invested into making airplane green.
Yeah, absolutely. And when do you think that we'll be able to see these green airplanes and like test it out?
Well, that's a very good question, because what I wish and what the regulators wish, but also the current state of the art. Mm-hmm. So there is a lot of research now, and really you can think that nowadays it's a race to make this airplane ready. The pledge for Airbus, that is the big airplane manufacturer of Europe, is that by 2035, we should start seeing the first green airplanes fly. It's a very long shot, and the US Boeing company, that is the other airplane manufacturer, is a bit more conservative into that. But let's say that I believe in the next 10-50 years, we will really see a lot of new airplanes with funkier shapes or funky technologies coming up and taking their first flight.
Yeah, that's really wonderful. And like going back to how you got interested in this, like that just having that very unexpected event inspired like the rest of your career is really, really beautiful. But yeah, I mean, we'll have to wait. I guess like policy has a factor in how and if we're going to get green flights anytime soon, right? So just like kind of like going back to like, I this is what I love about environmental science. You can't you make the technology. So this is like the engineering part, the aerospace engineering. But then like to actually implement it, you need that environmental policy and that like connect between the engineers and the politicians. So environmental science and just like that like bubble is so broad and like so interdisciplinary that there's a lot of skills and factors needed and to make something actually happen. So I can't wait till I'm able to fly in a hydrogen fueled plane, and I really can't wait. So I wanted to ask, like, what does your daily job with the like aviation look like?
So the daily job is in most of the cases, setting up the lab, mm-hmm. and start setting up the experiment. And then if everything is ready to go, taking some data. That's the daily job one. The other part is daily job two is like making sense of this data, see what they are telling me. And daily job three is like understanding whether these data are what we expect, what the models were predicting, or if there is some new physics that I can get out of them and that I can use to upgrade the models or to inform, let's say, inform colleagues that are working on that of some, let's say, new properties of the system.
Gotcha. Yeah. So like going back to that, like multifaceted experience of, you know, communicating, but also like doing the experiments and doing like the algorithms. So to like close off our lovely conversation, I just have a couple of questions about like what kind of advice you would give to people who young, maybe underrepresented people who are leaning towards like engineering, like with and trying to make the world more sustainable.
Yeah. So the first minority that I'd like to address are the people that feel that they don't fit into the field that want to work on. So women, we know that like women in let's say hardcore engineering, such as aerospace or mechanical engineering, are underrepresented. And that's also true for, let's say, some other minorities that might feel excluded by this community. And what I'd like to say to them is that we can change things, that like it's more important to have a job that you love for every day than like living all the days in a job you think you can fit in, but you don't like. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important for every person, for every parent and from every children to make sure they're like the little kid one, pursue their dream and follow the passion in what they want to do. So there are no barriers nowadays. And it is true that like sciences, like engineering, perhaps were way more male dominated in the past, but now things are changing. And actually we as young women academic, we are really making a lot of effort to make sure that like we are creating a more inclusive community that is representing all the, let's say, genders, races, if I can call them, or like background of the people, in order to create a community that is taking the potential from everyone and not only like giving the voice to a single person that is normally a white male grumpy man.
Absolutely. Yeah. This field is dominated by males, but that's why we have role models like you and all the other women we've interviewed on the podcast, just like there to show that you can do this, right? We can just like how the technology we're using right now can change, so can the people making that technology, that general group of people can change. And I think we have, there's so much optimism, so much hope, and it's happening right now. And like, you see so many more women in engineering and STEM in general, just powering their
Absolutely.
Way.
Absolutely, yeah.
So what do you need to learn in order to be, in your case, like an aerospace engineer?
It's a mixture within, let's say, theoretical like skills, such mm-hmm. as like algebra, maths in general, physics, fluid and solid mechanics, plus in my case, a bit of practical skills. Mm-hmm. But then it like later on is just like a lot of curiosity, a lot of like keeping up with innovation, making sure that you know what's around you, and making sure that you have a lot of curiosity, a lot of passion, and a lot of desire to change the world.
Right, exactly. I think that you know, physics is a wonderful subject. I'm taking physics in school right now, and I'm really learning that. And yeah, curiosity is needed. Just like being uncomfortable with being comfortable with the uncomfortable, is just like learning in general. So what do you wish you knew? What do you know today that you wish you knew when you first started out your career?
There is one thing that I'm really appreciating nowadays, that is the fact that is the thing that like we don't always need to know the answer in advance. Mm-hmm. And that's worse for so many things. So when I started, let's say, my career, I thought that I needed to be perfect in order to make sure that like I was respected by the people. Mm-hmm. And then the more I went on, the more I realized that not knowing things is fine. That not being perfect on the spot is also fine. And there are ways to improve this. So no one told me that like it's some skills such as leadership, such as networking skills, such as soft skills can be learned. I thought that I needed to have them, and I felt bad if I didn't show them at the right moment. And then moving on, I realized that there also these things can be trained. And there are a lot of like self-help books, courses, and mentorship schemes that are helping you to get all the potential out of you. And this is something that no one had told me before. And really, when I realized that there was all this support network outside there, that really made my life so much easier.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think that people listening to this podcast can take that away from it. Also, another piece of advice for them. But lastly, are there any other like interesting experiences or like significant learnings that you made that you have found in your career or while you were working on research?
Well, I can tell you perhaps something that is a failure turning in success because of like perseverance. And that's probably, I don't know, I hope that this might inspire someone in terms of knowing that like also people or everyone can make big mistake. So when I started one of the various research experiences that I was doing, nothing was working. So literally, like I spent 1 month on something that wasn't working, and I was exactly hired for that. So it was a very frustrating experience. And so many times I felt that I just wanted to drop the ball, leave and forget about that. And on the top of that, when I thought I was at the lowest ebb, the piece of equipment I was working on broke. We found out that it was not my fault. But, you know, if nothing is working and on the top of that, you break something that is about $100,000, then that really was not great. And that really made I was at the lowest mood at the time. But then I decided that, no, I wanted to give it another go. And then step by step, I started to not taking anything for granted, but slowly trying to make sure that I was taking into account everything, that I was like looking at things twice and try to look at things on a very different angle and way with respect to what I was doing before. Mm-hmm. And that eventually, things started getting better, starting improving. Up until at the end, I really succeed. And on the top of that, I managed to kind of like even do more of what I was hired for. So after, let's say, 2 months of downtime, I had 3 months in which I really things started thriving. And so the learning that I would like to share with people is the fact that like, even if something doesn't work at the beginning, you don't have to stop, but it's very important that you really believe in yourself, believe in your skills and your ability, and eventually will succeed.
Yeah, I think that's a wonderful, inspiring experience for people to take away. And lastly, if anyone would like to reach out to you, I know I contacted you through email, but what is the best way they can reach out to you?
You can find my page on the TUDAFT website. So it's Francesca De Domenico and on TUDAFT. But also you can contact, perhaps get in touch with you, and I'll give you my new email so that they can get it.
Gotcha. Yeah, I will put these links in the podcast description. And to remind our listeners, we've been speaking to Dr. Francesca De Domenico, and I really want to thank you for joining me here today and for your time. When we've talked about things like just improving flights and how we can use hydrogen and how you use lasers to measure the temperature of fire in a very, very cool terms. And just like your experiences from the rest of your very wonderful and successful career, and how it's important to keep persevering and not, never give up. And I've really appreciated talking to you. I've learned so much, and I'm sure the listeners have too. So thank you so much.
Thanks to you. It was really a pleasure to meet you and talk with you.
Yeah. And thanks for the listeners for listening.